The following podcast is a live recording of a radio show first broadcast by Fresh FM with assistance from New Zealand On Air.
Greetings everybody, and thanks very much for joining me for today's episode of Climate Matters. I'm Lindsay Wood from climate strategy company Resilience Limited, and Climate Matters is brought to you by Fresh FM, the top of the South's community access radio station. Well, today we have the second of two interviews with outgoing Nelson City Councillor Rachel Sanson. This time we take a rather wider view. We look at tangata whenua engagement with climate issues. We look at a bit at tourism, at forestry, and at what's known as a just transition. I do hope you enjoy it. And let's pass over to the interview with Rachel. Well, here we are again with the great pleasure of having Rachel Sanson back with us for interview number two. And those of you that listened before will know she talked very knowledgeably about many aspects of Nelson's climate change strategy. But we're going to go a bit wider this time. So tēnā koe, Rachel, it's lovely to have you back again.
Tēnā koe, Lindsay. Lovely to be back again.
First of all, can I jump straight into the area of tangata whenua and our Māori iwi and so on? And there's quite a paradox, it seems to me, between we've got an escalating climate crisis. Around the world, there's increasing recognition of Indigenous wisdom and Indigenous practices and so on. And in fact, the International Court of Justice recently made special mention of those. And yet, we've got a government regime that seems to be set on marginalising tangata whenua. So I'd be really interested how you see that playing out, how you'd like it to play out, how you see it might play out, and particularly if you can put a climate frame around it as well.
Yeah, thanks, Lindsay. I mean, I, as do so many others, recognise that Indigenous knowledge is vital for effective climate action. And I guess in Nelson, we see this firsthand or across Te Tau Ihu through the Te Tau Ihu intergenerational strategy that was developed in partnership with the eight iwi of Te Tau Ihu or Te Waka o Maui, and embeds concepts like whaka tupuranga, being intergenerational wellbeing, and kaitiakitanga, guardianship, you know, which are essential for long-term climate resilience. So I think it's really a local blueprint for how to value and integrate this wisdom. I guess, you know, and both councils endorsed the intergenerational strategy. So I guess while at a local government level we embrace this partnership-led approach, central government actions appear to be moving in the opposite direction. And I think that the policies and rhetoric that we're seeing from the current government are marginalising tangata whenua and creating a direct conflict with the collaborative spirit we really need to tackle these complex climate challenges together. You know, I think it has real-world consequences, which we can see through things like the resource management reform, which is weakening iwi participation and environmental oversight. Mm-hmm. We're undermining the treaty partnership. And I think that the role of council in these times is really to hold firm to our local commitments. I feel confident that we've done that to date, and I really hope that the incoming council will continue to do so. And I think for the wider community in the upcoming election, we're going to be asked, we're in a referendum, in a binding referendum, whether to support Māori wards or not. And I just urge everybody to really, if they're thinking of voting no, to really ask themselves why would it be a threat for them, and what do they have to lose? I feel like we have everything to gain from Māori wards and collaboration and cooperation with tangata whenua, and everything to lose by not doing that. So,
can I just, for point of clarification, Rachel, when you said a binding referendum, that is binding on the Nelson City Council, is that what we're saying?
That's right. So, if we get a majority of community members, I guess elected of voters, say yes to the Māori ward, then we will retain the Māori ward.
Well, let's hope we do, and time will tell very shortly. I'm so glad you mentioned the Te Tau Ihu intergenerational strategy. I just love its tagline, being good ancestors. I think that speaks volumes. So thank you for drawing that into the conversation. I'd like to move on now to another area that you've had a close involvement with council, although people very often might not realise that Nelson City has quite substantial forestry holdings. And I know from my own involvement many years ago, probably 6 or 7 years ago, trying to find out about those holdings, where they were at, and so on, was like trying to find a needle in a haystack. What do we need to do to make our approach to regional forestry truly climate responsible? That's one thing. And the other, I suppose, is what you see as what we need to do looking forward to make sure that the good changes that were recently adopted by the council persist and are honoured.
Thanks, Lindsay. Yeah, I mean, I feel like Nelson's actually comparatively small forestry holding has an outsized presence in the last 6 years of my life. I mean, we have about 600 hectares, which is less than 0.5% of the region's forestry. But we had an opportunity to do things differently and better, and I just feel so appreciative of the community who got behind that, and then other elected members who've supported the transition. So we are on our way, well on our way to transitioning out of commercial forestry into permanent forests. And I think that I'm really hopeful that we will actually lead the way for the region in terms of diversifying beyond pine monoculture. So there is really an opportunity for us in the top of the south, where we've got so many skilled people and so much land in forestry, to be doing it differently and to be planting a wider range of exotic and native species, particularly higher value species that don't require large scale clear felling, having the co-benefits of building resilience, not leaving large swaths of land cleared and susceptible to erosion and the impacts of weather events. And I think that there's been some great work done by Pure Advantage in their Recloaking Papatūānuku work that has shown us, or shown all of us really, a way forwards. And I definitely drew on their work and research quite a lot when I was considering how Nelson City Council could be doing it better.
Can I just interrupt him briefly? I'm so glad you mentioned Recloaking Papatūānuku. And listeners should know, but just a reminder in case it slipped. Very recently, Pure Advantage released their film Think Like a Forest, which was their a promo or introduction to that concept. It's streamable, but I won't go into the details at the moment. Thank you for that, Rachel. Just picking back on you mentioned continuous cover, but oh, no, actually, I don't think you did mention continuous cover, but I'm interested to know the concept of continuous cover forestry and what that means. Are we talking of a place where you can still extract trees from that forest as long as you leave an intact canopy, or is it a
Yes,
bit
so
more complex
I
than that?
think there are different ways of undertaking more sustainable forestry and better forest management. And it can be things like selective harvesting, where you are extracting single high-value logs. It can also be much smaller kind of coupe harvesting. So if you think of the forest as a mosaic and you're only taking a small amount of, like only clearing or felling trees from a small pocket in that whole mosaic. And as long as you're kind of retaining enough of the forest mass, obviously, you retain its integrity and all those biodiversity values that come with that as well.
That's great to hear because I'm quite familiar with aspects of Germany, and even I was even had a close connection with a forester in Germany at one stage, and they two things is that selective harvesting, like you were just describing, is second nature to them there, and the other thing is they look at our hillsides here where it looks like they've had a short back and sides over the whole hillside, and they're aghast at the what they see as desecration of nature and all of that.
Obviously, we've seen through both on Tairāwhiti, Gisborne, and out here in Tasman, and the most recent two weather events, just the devastating impacts of plantation forestry and clear felling on high erosion land. And we really just need to be doing things differently. Like, we need to embrace the right tree, right place planting across our region, so that we are reforesting in those highly erodible areas with permanent forests. And that could mean, selective logging in the future. But until then, it means that we'll have hopefully more resilient land cover that protects the communities in the catchments below.
Exactly. And also has a quite a different concept of a forest too, isn't it? Where the forest's integrity and durability is preeminent rather than its ability to quickly generate some logs, which are often just shipped almost in entirety off to Asia to make paper pallets anyway.
Yeah, I mean, those kind of externalized costs and benefits are really not often factored into the decision making. And I just think of, the costs, I mean, hundreds of millions of dollars incurred to fix infrastructure and that kind of thing from the latest weather event. And we know that if we have permanently forested hillsides, they dissipate the impact of those water flows. And I guess the other factor in our forestry industry that we really need to be considering is how we're dealing with slash and, the byproducts from forestry. And unfortunately, whilst post the weather event in Tairāwhiti, there was a ministerial review and an update to the NES, National Environmental Standard for Plantation Forestry. It strengthened requirements around dealing with slash and also gave councils some powers as to where they could determine forestry was appropriate to happen or not. In the NES for commercial forestry, those strengthened provisions are currently being consulted on, and it's signaled that they're likely to be weakened under the current government's approach.
Yes, it's sad, isn't it? It's a, and don't get me started on externalities, Rachel. We could go forever. I'd like to move into another of Nelson's pillar industries, if you like, and that is tourism. We know that it's a major part of Nelson. We like to think of ourselves as one of the tourism jewels in New Zealand's crown. But there are big climate questions hanging over the viability of tourism. Do you think we can sustain a climate-friendly tourism sector? And if you do feel so, I'd love to have your insights. How you think we might approach that?
Yeah, I do, Lindsay. Having been involved in tourism for a long time, almost 20 years,
Oh, wow, I
I've
didn't know that.
done some soul searching around, the impacts of, flying internationally and impacts on local communities. And I do think that We really do have something special to offer in our region, and I think we should really be framing our region as a destination, not a journey. So encourage people to come and stay for a week, 2 weeks, a month, and to really soak up everything on offer here. Local crafts, local foods, all our national parks, great cycleways, friendly communities. So I think that, and I guess really also encouraging lots of national or domestic visitors. I think international are going to be a factor for some time until, flying internationally becomes unaffordable, or I guess maybe in the future, I can imagine a time where it may not be kind of socially acceptable anymore just to fly off on a holiday. I know personally a number of people who no longer fly internationally for just for a holiday. They may do if it's, for family reasons, but not just for a holiday. And I'm certainly, my partner and I, we haven't flown internationally since COVID, and we really both question when we will do that and in what situation. So I think as climate impacts really start to bite further, there will be a bigger discussion around that.
You're right, Rachel. And the question of should we be losing a social license to travel purely for recreational or relaxation? Yes, I'm with you. You haven't quite convinced me that it'll be completely climate friendly, but you put some good strategies out there, particularly the sort of stay in one place and enjoy it rather than whiz around constantly on the move is one part of it, isn't it?
I mean, I think obviously there's lots that could be done probably locally in terms of supporting, decarbonisation of tourism infrastructure. So, electrification, the electrification of transport fleets and improving cycling infrastructure and public transport infrastructure so that it's easier for people to get around in a lower emissions way. I guess
I mean,
something
that's
that
a
we also probably need to be doing is ensuring that we've got sufficient, EV charging and that kind of thing.
Good re response to my challenge. Thanks, Rachel.
One other suggestion.
Please go for it.
So I would really like to see, and this isn't my idea. This has actually come from Councillor Aaron Stallard. I know it's a pet passion of his, but I absolutely support his ambition in this space, and that is having an airport departure climate contribution, so some kind of a passenger departure levy, so that people who are visiting Nelson and, or those of us who travel out of Nelson make some contribution to a local climate fund. So obviously we need to recognise that for now air travel is here to stay. As much as we recognise the impacts of it, it's not going anywhere anytime soon. But we are really struggling as a community to fund climate initiatives and climate action. And I think introducing something that would generate funds like a departure levy could be a useful mechanism. Or we could look at something like a climate targeted rate, as they've done at Auckland Council. I think they're generating some millions of dollars a year through there for climate action.
Very good. Thank you for that. Watch this space with interest. Before we close, I do want to go into the area of a just transition, because you've been active in the social well-being space as well as all the other things we've been talking about. For as long as I can remember, when people talk about climate policy, they talk about the importance of a just transition and making sure that the disadvantaged aren't further disadvantaged by it. It's been a global catch cry. But do you see as the what you might call the climate justice issues in our region, Rachel, and how might we address them or avoid the pitfalls that they might represent?
Yeah, thanks, Lindsay. This is a really important question, and I watched with interest and quite a lot of support, as there was a whole lot of work done on the just transition under the last government. And it's just really disappointing to see that that information has been completely removed from, I think it's the Ministry for the Environment's website. It's no longer a feature of government policy at this time. But we definitely have a role to play in local government. And I think, a pretty critical role to play, actually, as we've seen through the weather event, the August 22 weather event, where a number of neighbourhoods and homeowners were impacted by flooding and landslips. So I think for me, probably the first thing is housing. We already have something of a housing crisis in the region. We've got around 1,000 families who are experiencing extreme housing vulnerability. And as low-lying coastal and riverside communities are impacted by sea level rise and flooding, it's often lower-income households that are in those areas, Tohunanui, Manaakau, and The Wood. And so they face the greatest risk of flooding and displacement. And so we really need to be looking at how we can engage with the whole community around intensification and more resilient areas and planning to ensure that those families and households are not financially impacted, and also, that they don't become homeless with no housing options.
Thank you. That's a good answer, and I hope that we maintain a responsible approach to that going into the future. Well, we've reached the end, Rachel, except not quite the end, because first of all, I want to take this chance to thank you for everything you've done for our region in the last 6 years. I know you've worked tirelessly, but I also would like you to have a chance to tell listeners what's front of mind for you at the moment, and also, if you can, give us a glimpse into what's next for Rachel Sampson, because your term at council ends in just over a month.
Thanks, Lindsay. I mean, front of mind is really just the ongoing work of council. Like, I'll give it everything to my very last day.
I'm sure I can't imagine it being otherwise.
And then I think, and personally, I'm actually going to take a brief sabbatical, and I'm going to recharge and refocus and think about where I can next put my kind of focus and energy to maximize, positive impact for our community and our region. So I haven't made firm plans yet, and I'm trying not to jump into anything too quickly. It would be very easy to jump from one thing to the next, but I actually feel like I really want to just pause and catch my breath and go, where next? Feels like quite a significant transition.
Well said, and I'm actually very pleased that you're giving yourself some time out, both because I think anybody under the sort of pressures of council deserves that, but also it'll make your next trajectory or next chapter all the better founded as a result. Well, Rachel, thank you so much for joining us for a couple of very interesting interviews. Lovely to have your company and get your insights. I wish you well in the future, and I look forward to seeing you around in a different capacity in the future.
Thanks so much, Lindsay. Always a pleasure to catch up with you. And just thanks for all the work that you do in our community advocating for climate action. Really appreciate your support and expertise and wisdom, particularly in these last 6 years. It's been invaluable.
Thank you so much. I wasn't expecting that, but I'll bank it. Well, that closes two fabulous interviews with Rachel Sampson. Isn't it wonderful to get her insight into things and tap into her experience while she's been on the council? As you know, you're listening to Fresh FM, the top of the South's community access radio station. Fresh FM broadcasts in Blenheim on 88.9, to Eastern Golden Bay on 95.0, to the Nelson CBD on 107.2, and across the Nelson Tasman region on 104.8. It's also streamed to the planet on freshfm.co.nz, and podcasts of Climate Matters and of other locally produced shows are available through freshfm.co.nz and through the accessmedia.nz app. Well, this is going to be broadcast, I think it's on the 21st of September, so I'm recording this at the end of August, so there'll be a lot of water under the bridge on climate meetings and candidate meetings, but do, if you haven't intended to vote, do vote. If you know young people especially, give them an encouragement to vote, help them if need be. It's really important. And anyway, in a couple of weeks, we'll know the results. I hope it's a climate-friendly result. This is Lindsay Wood signing off, thanking you for your company, and as always, asking you, kia kaha for the climate.
The podcast you just listened to was a live recording of a radio show, first broadcast on Fresh FM with support from New Zealand On Air. Fresh FM is a community access media station based in Te Tauihu, the top of the South Island, New Zealand. The funding of Access Media makes these podcasts possible. To find similar programs by other community access media stations, go online to accessmedia.nz. If you or your group would like to know more about how you can have a program on our station, please contact us. Visit our website, freshfm.net, for our contact details.